I'm so very happy you've come.
I'm glad to hear that, said Anna. I feared you might resent me.
I could never resent you, Clinch cried. I could never. But why?
In the next moment he understood.
You're going to contest the widow's claim on that fortune.
She nodded.
There's a document that names me as an inheritor.
Is there? Said Clinch, wincing. Signed and everything?
Found in his stove. In Crosby Wells' stove. Someone tried to burn it.
But is it signed?
£2,000, said Anna.
Oh, you have always been such a father to me, Edgar. I don't mind telling you. He meant it as a present. £2,000 as a present all at once. He loves me. He's loved me all along.
Who? Said Edgar Clinch, sourly. But he already knew. As Löwenthal was returning to the newspaper offices on Weld Street, he heard someone call his name. He turned and saw Dick Mannering striding towards him, a paper folded beneath his arm.
I have a juicy piece of news for you, Ben, Mannering said, though you may have heard it already. Would you like to hear a juicy piece of news?
Löwenthal frowned, distracted.
What is it?
Rumour has it that Gov Shepherd's taken out a warrant for Mr. Sook's arrest. Apparently Mr. Sook turned up in Hokitika this morning and laid down cash money for a military weapon. How about that?
Does he mean to use it?
Why would one buy a gun, said Mannering cheerfully, except to use it? I dare say that we can expect a shootout in the thoroughfare. A shootout in the American style.
I have some news also, said Löwenthal, as they turned into Revel Street and began walking south. Another rumour, and no less juicy than yours.
About our Mr. Sook?
About our Mr. Staines, said Löwenthal.
Hui Long was slicing vegetables for soup at his hut in Chinatown when he heard hoofbeats approaching and then someone shouting hello. He went to the doorway and pulled back the Hessian curtain with one hand.
You there, said the man on the threshold, who had just dismounted. You've been summoned by the law. I'm to take you to the Hokitika courthouse.
Hui Long put up his hands.
Not Ah Sook, he said. Ah Kui.
I bloody well know who you are, the man said, and it's you I want. Come along, quick as you're able. There's a buggy waiting, come.
Ah Kui, said Ah Kui again.
I know who you are. It's to do with the fortune you dug up on the Aurora.
The Arahura,
said Ah Kui, mishearing him.
That's right, the man said. Now get a move on. You've been summoned by a Mr. John Fellows on behalf of the Magistrates' Court.
After leaving the Reserve Bank, Mr. Fellows paid a call upon Harold Nilsson at Nilsson & Co. He found the commission merchant in his office, drawing up a balance sheet on George Shepherd's behalf. The work was dreary, and Nilsson was pleased to be roused from it. Pleased, that is, until the lawyer handed him the charred contract bearing the signatures of Emery Staines and Crosby Wells. Nilsson's face drained of colour at once.
"Have you ever seen this document before?"
said Fellows. But Nilsson was a man who learned from his mistakes.
"Before I answer you," he said cautiously, "I'd like to know who sent you, and what's your purpose with me?"
The lawyer nodded.
"That's fair," he said. The girl Wetherall received this document this morning from an anonymous source, slid under the front door while her mistress was out. It's a tidy sum of money, and by all appearances it's bound for her pocket, as you can see. But it stinks of a set-up. We don't know who sent it, or why."
Nilsson had already betrayed Carl Devlin once. He would not do so a second time.
"I see," he said, keeping his face impassive. "So you are working for Miss Wetherill?"
"I'm not associated with any whores," Fellows said sharply. "I'm just doing a bit of research, that's all. Getting the lay of the land."
"Of course," Nilsson murmured. "Forgive me."
"You were the man who cleared Crosby Wells' estate,
Fellows went on. All I want to know is whether this piece of paper was among his possessions when you were called in to clear the place.
No, it was not, said Nielsen, truthfully.
And we cleared that cottage top to bottom. You have my word on that.
All right, Fellows said.
Thanks.
He stood, and Nielsen rose also. As they did so, the bells in the Wesleyan chapel rang out the hour. It was 5:15.
Very fine donation you made, by the way, said Fellows as he made to leave. Your support of the new jailhouse on Sea View. Very fine.
Thank you,
said Nielsen, speaking tartly.
It's a rare thing in this day and age to meet a truly charitable man, said the lawyer. I commend you for it.
Mr. Staines.
The boy's eyes fluttered open, blurred, focused, and came to rest on Joseph Pritchard, who was crouching over him.
Why, it's Pritchard, he said. The druggist.
Pritchard reached out a gentle hand and pulled back the collar of Staines' shirt to expose the blackened wound beneath. The boy did not protest. His eyes searched Pritchard's face as the chemist examined the wound.
Did you manage to scrape up a piece of it?
He whispered. Pritchard's face was somber. A piece of what?
A piece of the resin, the boy said. You said you'd stand me a piece of it.
I brought something to take the edge away, Pritchard said shortly. You've found a thirst for the smoke, have you? That's a nasty wound you got there.
A thirst, the boy said. I said it was like a thorn. I never heard the shot, you know. I was in the coffin at the time.
How long have you been here? When was the last time you ate?
3 days, the boy said. Was it 3 days? It's very good of you. Excessively kind. I suppose it was midnight. I fancied a walk.
He's not talking sense, Pritchard said.
No, said Tafari. Will he die?
He doesn't look too thin, Pritchard said, feeling Stain's cheek and forehead with the back of his hand. Someone's been feeding him at least. Or he's managed to scavenge wherever he's been.
Christ!
8 weeks. Something more than prayers is holding this one together. Stain's gaze drifted over Pritchard's shoulder to Taufari, standing behind him.
The Maoris are the very best of guides, he said, smiling. You'll do beautifully.
Listen, Pritchard said to Staines, pulling his collar over the wound again. We've got to get you onto the trap. We're going to take you back to Hokitika so that Dr. Gillies can take that bullet out of your shoulder. Once you're on the trap, I'll give you something to take the edge away. All right? The boy's head had fallen forward.
Hokitika, he mumbled. Anna Magdalena.
Anna's in Hokitika waiting for you, said Pritchard. Come on now. The sooner the better. We'll have you in town before dark.
He wrote to her an aria, said the boy, as a token. I never made a vow.
Pritchard lifted Stain's good arm, draped it over his shoulder, and stood. Taufari grabbed the boy around the waist, and together the two men carried him out of the cottage and hauled him onto the trap. The boy was still mumbling. His skin was slick with sweat and very hot. They arranged him on the seat of the trap in such a way that Pritchard and Taufari could sit on either side of him and prevent him from falling forward, and Taufari tucked his woolen coat about the boy's legs. At last, Pritchard produced the jar of laudanum from his pocket and uncorked it. It's very bitter, I'm afraid. But it'll take the edge off, he said, cupping the back of Stain's neck with one hand and holding the bottle to his mouth. There it is, he said. There it is. Goes down easy, doesn't it? One more swallow. There it is. One more. Now settle back, Mr. Staines, and close your eyes. You'll be asleep in no time.
Alistair Lauderback, upon quitting the Hokitika courthouse, had gone immediately to the office of the shipping agent, Thomas Balfour.
He flung his copy of Godspeed's bill of sale onto Balfour's desk, seated himself without invitation, and cried, "He's still at it, Tom! Francis Carver is still at it! He'll bleed me till the bloody day I die!" It took Balfour a very long time to make sense of this theatrical statement, to understand in full the protection and indemnity scheme under which Godspeed had been insured, and to venture his own opinion, finally, that perhaps Lauderback ought to admit defeat, in this round at least. Francis Carver, it seemed, had bested him. The ambiguous signature was a piece of cleverness that Lauderback could not easily contest, and as for the matter of Godspeed's insurance policy, Carver was legally entitled to draw down those funds, and Mr. Garrity had already seen fit to approve the transaction. But the politician was loath to accept such sensible advice, and persisted in sighing, clutching his hair, and cursing Francis Carver. By 5 o'clock, Balfour's patience was long since spent.
"I'm not the man to talk to," he said at last. "I don't know a scrap about the ins and outs of the law. You shouldn't be talking to me." "Who, then?" "Go and talk to the commissioner."
"He's out of town."
"What about the magistrate?"
"On the eve of the elections, are you mad?"
"Shepherd, then. Show this to George Shepherd and see what he thinks."
"Mr. Shepherd and I are not on good terms," Lauderback said.
"Well, all right," Balfour said, exasperated. "But Shepherd's not on good terms with Carver, don't forget. He might be able to give you a leg up on that account."
"What's Shepherd's beef with Carver?" Lauderback asked.
Balfour frowned at him.
"Carver did his time under Shepherd," he said, "as a convict. Shepherd was a penitentiary sergeant on Cockatoo Island at Port Jackson, and Carver did his time there."
"Oh," said Lauderback.
"Didn't you know that?"
"No,"
said Lauderback.
"Why should I?"
"I just expected that you might," said Balfour.
"I don't know George Shepherd from a stick of chalk," said Lauderback stoutly.
Aubert Gascoigne had completed his business at the Reserve Bank in the mid-afternoon. When the clock struck 5, he was back at the courthouse, compiling a record of that day's petty sessions for the West Coast Times. He was surprised when the foyer door opened and Anna Wetherill walked in. She gave him only a cursory greeting, however, en route to shake Mr. Fellow's hand. They exchanged several words that Gascoigne could not hear, and then the lawyer gestured her into a private office and closed the door.
"What's Anna doing with Fellows?" Gascoigne said to his colleague, Burke.
"Haven't the foggiest," said Burke. "She came by earlier while you were at the bank. Wanted to speak to a lawyer about something private."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Because it wasn't bloody news," said Burke.
"Hello, there's Gov Shepherd."
George Shepherd was striding across the hall towards them.
"Mr. Gascoigne, Mr. Burke," he said. "Good afternoon."
"Good afternoon."
"I've come to collect a warrant for a Chinaman's arrest."
"It's ready for you, sir."
Burke went to fetch the warrant. Shepherd waited with restrained impatience, his hands on his hips, his fingers tapping. Gascoigne was staring at Fellow's office door. Suddenly, from behind it, there came a muffled thump, rather like the sound of a body falling downstairs, and in the next moment Fellows was shouting,
"Give us a hand! Give us a hand in here!"
Gascoigne crossed the hall to the office and opened the door. Anna Wetherill was lying prone, her eyes closed, her mouth half open. The lawyer Fellows was kneeling beside her, shaking her arm.
"Out for the count," said Fellows. "She just collapsed. Pitched forward right over the table."
He turned to Gascoigne, pleading,
"I didn't do anything. I didn't touch her."
The jailer had come up behind them.
"What's going on?"
Gascoigne knelt and leant close to her.
"She's breathing," he said. "Let's get her up."
He lifted her into a sitting position, marvelling at how thin and wasted her limbs had become. Her head lolled back. He caught it in the crook of his elbow.
"Did she hit her head?"
"Nothing like that," said Fellows, who was wearing a very frightened look. "She just fell sideways. Looks like she's drunk, but she didn't seem drunk when she walked in. I swear I didn't touch her."
"Maybe she fainted."
"Use your heads, both of you," said Shepherd.
I can smell the laudanum from here.
Gascoigne could smell it too, thick and bitter. He slipped a finger into Anna's mouth and worked her jaw open.
There's no staining, he said. If it were laudanum, her tongue would be brown, wouldn't it? Her teeth would be stained.
Take her to the jailhouse,
Shepherd said. Gascoigne frowned.
Perhaps the hospital.
The jail, Shepherd said. I've had enough of this whore and her theatrics. Take her to the police camp and chain her to the rail, and sit her upright so she can breathe.
Fellows was shaking his head.
I don't know what happened, he said. One moment she was stone-cold sober, the next she came over all drowsy, and the next...
The foyer door opened again.
A Mr. Quay for Mr. Fellows, came the call.
Burke had come up behind them.
Excuse me, Mr. Shepherd, he said. Here's your warrant for Mr. Sook's arrest.
Mr. Quay, said Gascoigne, turning. What's he doing here?
Take the whore away, the jailer said.
Sook Yong-sheng, lying on the bare boards beneath George Shepherd's bed, was listening to the bells in the Wesleyan chapel ring out 5:30, when there came another rap at the cottage door. He turned his head to the side and listened for Margaret Shepherd's footsteps. She padded down the hall, lifted the latch, and drew the bolt, and then the square of lightness on the calico wall widened again, and he felt the cool breath of the outside air. The light was bluer now and less intense, and the shadow in the doorway was a muted grey.
Mrs. Shepherd, I presume?
Yes.
I wonder if I might have a word with your husband. Is he available?
No,
said Margaret Shepherd, for the second time that day.
He's gone down to the courthouse on business.
What a shame. Might I wait for him?
You'd do better to make an appointment, she said.
I take it that he's not likely to return.
He often spends his night at Sea View, she said, and sometimes he plays billiards in town.
I see.
Sook Yong-sheng did not know Alistair Lauderback's voice, but he could tell from the tone and volume that the man speaking was someone of some authority.
Forgive me for disturbing you, Lauderback went on. Perhaps you might do me the favour of telling your husband that I came by.
Yes, of course.
You do know who I am, don't you?
You're Mr. Lauderback,
she whispered.
Very good. Tell him that I should like to discuss a mutual acquaintance. Francis Carver is the man's name.
I'll tell him.
That man will be dead before the morning, thought Sook Yong-sheng. The door closed again. The bedroom darkened. Cowell Devlin made room for Anna Wetherill in the corner of the police camp jailhouse, thinking as he did so that she made for a much more wretched picture than she had 2 months prior, following her attempt upon her own life. She was not feverish as she had been then, and she did not mumble in her sleep or lash about, but she seemed all the sorrier for sleeping so peacefully, clad in her black mourning gown. She was so thin. Devlin manacled her with great regret, and as loosely as he was able. He asked Mrs. Shepherd to bring a blanket to place beneath her head. This instruction was silently obeyed.
"What's the meaning of it?"
he said to Gascoigne, as he folded the blanket over his knee.
"I saw Anna only this morning. I escorted her to the courthouse myself. Did she go straight to Pritchard's and buy a file of the stuff?"
"Pritchard's is closed," Gascoigne said. "It's been closed all afternoon."
Devlin slipped his palm beneath Anna's head and slid the folded blanket beneath.
Well then, where did she get her hands on a file of laudanum, for heaven's sake?
Perhaps she'd had it all along.
No, said Devlin. When she left the Wayfarer's fortune this morning, she wasn't carrying a reticule or wallet of any kind. She didn't even have any money on her person, as far as I'm aware. Someone must have given it to her.
But why?
Gascoigne wanted very much to know why Cowell Devlin had gone to the Wayfarer's fortune that morning, and what had happened there. As he was thinking of a polite way to ask, however, there came the rattle and clop of a trap approaching, and then Pritchard's voice.
"Hello in there! It's Joe Pritchard with Emery Staines!"
Devlin's face was almost comical in its astonishment. Gascoigne had already rushed outside by the time he got to his feet. The chaplain hurried after him and saw in the courtyard Joseph Pritchard climbing down from the driver's seat of a trap and leading the horses to be tethered at the jailhouse post. On the seat of the trap, Terau Taufari was sitting with both arms around a white-faced, sunken-eyed boy. Devlin stared at the boy. This was Emery Staines, this limp, inconsequential thing? The boy was much younger than he had envisaged. Why, he was but 21, perhaps even younger. He was barely older than a child.
Taufari found him hiding out in Crosby's cottage, Pritchard said shortly. He's very sick, as you can see. Give us a hand getting him down.
You're not taking him to jail, Devlin said.
Of course not, Pritchard said. He's going to the hospital. He needs to see Dr. Gillies at once.
Don't, said Gascoigne.
What?
Said Pritchard.
You won't last an hour if you take him there,
Gascoigne said.
Well, we can't exactly take him back to his own rooms, said Pritchard.
Get him a hotel, then. Get him a room somewhere. Anywhere's better than a hospital.
Give us a hand, Pritchard said again, and someone send for Dr. Gillies while we're at it. He'll have the last word.
They helped Emery Staines down from the trap.
Mr. Staines, said Pritchard, do you know where you are?
Anna Magdalena,
he mumbled.
Where's Anna?
Anna's right here, said Carol Devlin. She's right inside.
His eyes opened.
I want to see her.
He's not talking sense, said Pritchard. He doesn't know what he's saying.
I want to see Anna, said the boy, suddenly lucid. Where is she? I want to see her.
He seems coherent to me, said Gascoigne.
Bring him inside, said Devlin, just until the doctor gets here. Come on, it's what he wants. Bring him into the jail.
The Greater Malefic, in which Sukyong Sheng overhears the beginning of a conversation. Ah Suk crouched in the allotment behind the Crown Hotel, his back against the timber of the building, his knees bent, the Kerr patent revolver cradled loosely in both his hands. He looked like an altogether different man from the one who had purchased the pistol that morning. Margaret Shepherd had cut off his pigtail, shadowed his chin and throat with blacking, and thickened his eyebrows with the same. She had found a threadbare jacket for him, and a shirt of jail-issued twill, and a red kerchief to tie about his neck. With the brim of his hat turned down and the collar of his jacket turned up, he did not look Chinese in the slightest. Walking the 300-yard distance from the police camp to the Crown, he had not attracted the least bit of attention from anyone at all. Now, crouched in the allotment, he was all but invisible in the darkness. Inside the hotel, two people were talking, a man and a woman. Their voices came down to him quite clearly through the gap between the window shutter and the frame.
"Looks like it'll come off," the man was saying. "Protected and indemnified."
"You still sound uneasy," said the woman.
"Yes."
"What are you doubting? The money's in your hand, almost."
"You know I don't trust a fellow without connections. I couldn't dig up anything on this Gascoigne at all. He arrived in Hokitika sometime before Christmas. Landed himself a job at the courthouse without any fuss. Lives alone. No friends to speak of. You say he's nothing but a dandy. I say, how do I know that Lauderback hasn't set him up?"
"He does have one connection. He brought a friend along to the opening of the Wayfarer's Fortune, I recall. An aristocratic type."
"What does he go by? The friend?"
"Walter Moody was his name."
"He can't be Adrian Moody's son."
"That was my first thought, too. He did speak with a Scottish lilt."
"Well, there you have it. They must be related."
There was the clink of glasses.
"I saw him just before I left Dunedin," the man went on. Adrian, I mean. Tight as all get up.
And out for blood, no doubt, said the woman.
I don't like a man beyond his own control.
No, the woman agreed, and Moody is of the worst variety, the kind of man who loves to be offended so that he can vent his temper, for he knows not how to vent it otherwise. He's a decent man when he's sober.
But anyway, the man said, if this chap Gascoigne is in thick with one of the Moody family, he ought to do us fine. His advice ought to be fine.
The family resemblance is excessively slight. The mother's features must have been strong.
The man laughed. You're never short of an opinion, Greenway. An opinion is one thing you've always got on hand. There was another pause, and then the woman said,
He came over on Godspeed, in fact.
Moody?
Yes.
No, he can't have.
Francis, don't contradict me. He told me himself that evening.
No, the man said. There was no one with the name of Moody. There were only 8 of them, and I looked the paper over. I would have remembered that name.
Perhaps you overlooked it, said the woman. You know I hate to be contradicted. Let's not disagree.
How would I overlook the name Moody? Why, that's like overlooking Hanover or Plantagenet. The woman laughed.
I would hardly compare Adrian Moody to a royal line.
Ah Suk heard the squeak of a chair and the shifting of weight over floorboards.
I only mean I'd have recognized it. Would you pass over the name Carver?
The woman made a noise in her throat.
He most definitely said that he'd come over on Godspeed, she said. I remember it vividly. We exchanged some words on the subject.
Something's not right, the man said.
Well, have you got the passenger list? Surely you've a copy of the Times from when the ship came in. Why don't you check it?
Yes, you're right. Hang a bit. I'll go and look in the smoking room. They keep a stack of old broadsheets on the secretary.
The door opened and closed. The lamp in the next room came on, illuminating one corner of the allotment in a glow of muted yellow. Carver was in the smoking room of the Crown Hotel, and away from Lydia Wells at last. Ah Suk raised himself up slightly. He saw through the window that Carver had his back to the door and was shuffling through the papers on the secretary. As far as he could see, there was nobody else in the room. In the bedroom, Lydia Wells began to hum a little ditty to herself. Ah Suk got to his feet. Holding the Kerr patent against his thigh and moving as softly as he was able in his digger's boots, he crept around the back of the house to the tradesman's door. He turned into the alley and froze.
Drop your arms.
Standing on the far side of the alley, his face in shadow, a long-handled pistol in his hand, was the jail's governor, George Shepherd. Ah Suk did not move. His eyes went to Shepherd's pistol, and then back to Shepherd's face.
Drop it, Shepherd said. I will shoot you. Drop the piece now.
Still Ah Suk said nothing. Still he did not move.
You will kneel down and place your revolver on the ground, Shepherd said. You will do that now, or you will die. Kneel.
Ah Suk sank to his knees, but he did not release the Kerr patent. His finger tightened on the hammer.
I will shoot you dead before you have time to cock and aim, Shepherd said. Make no mistake about it. Drop your arms.
Margaret, said Ah Suk.
Yes, Shepherd said. She sent me a message.
Ah Suk shook his head. He could not believe it.
She is my wife, Shepherd said curtly. And she was my brother's wife before me. You remember my brother, I trust. You ought to.
No.
Again Ah Suk's finger tightened on the hammer.
You do not remember him, or you do not believe that you ought to remember.
No,
said Ah Suk stubbornly.
Let me jog your memory. Shepherd said. He died at the White Horse Saloon at Darling Harbour, shot through the temple at close range. Do you remember him now? Jeremy Shepherd was his name.
I remember.
Good, said Shepherd. So do I.
I did not murder him.
Still singing the same old tune, I see.
Margaret,
said Suk Yong Sheng again, still kneeling.
Francis!
Hush a moment, hush!
What are you listening for?
Hush!
I can't hear anything.
Nor can I. That's good.
It was so close.
Poor lamb. Did it alarm you?
Only a bit. I thought...
Never mind. Most likely it was just an accident. Someone cleaning their piece.
I couldn't help but imagine that horrible Chinaman.
Nothing's going to come of him. He'll head straight to the palace, and he'll be rounded up before the morning.
You've been so afraid of him, Francis.
Come here.
All right. All right. I've recovered now. Let's see what you found.
Here.
There was a rustling noise.
Look, McKitchen, Morley, Parrish, see? 8 in total, and no mention of a Walter Moody anywhere.
There was a short period of quiet as she looked the paper over and checked the date.
Presently he said, strange thing to tell a lie about, especially when his partner shows up out of nowhere a few weeks later and starts yammering to me about insurance. I'm just a chap who tells another chap about loopholes, he said.
One of these names must be a false one. If your passengers truly numbered 8, and Walter Moody was truly among them.
8, and all accounted for. They took the lighter into shore that afternoon, 6 hours, maybe 7 hours before we rolled.
Then he must have taken a false name.
Why would he do that?
Well, perhaps he was lying then. About having come over on Godspeed.
Why would he do that?
Evidently, Lydia Wells could not produce a response to this either, for after a moment she said,
What are you thinking, Francis?
I'm thinking to write my old friend Adrian a letter.
Yes, do, said Mrs. Wells, and I shall make some inquiries of my own.
The insurance money did come through. Gascoigne was as good as his word.
Presently, she said,
Let's to bed.
You've had a trying day.
A very trying day.
It'll all come out right in the end.
She'll get what she deserves, said Mrs. Wells.
I should also like to get what I deserve, Francis.
It's dreary for you, waiting.
Frightfully.
Hmm.
Are you not tired of it also?
Well, I cannot show you off in the street as I would like.
How would you show me off?
Carver did not reply to this.
After a short silence, he said, low, You'll be Mrs. Carver soon.
I have set my sights upon it,
said Lydia Wells, and then nobody spoke for a long time. Equinox, in which the lovers sleep through much commotion. George Shepherd directed Suk Yong Sheng's body to be brought into his private study at the police camp and laid out on the floor. The blacking on the man's chin and throat seemed all the more gruesome in death. Mrs. George, as the body was brought in, breathed very deeply, as though steadying herself internally against a wind. Carol Devlin, arriving from the police camp jailhouse, looked down at the body in shock. The hatter perfectly recalled the hermit, Crosby Wells, who had been laid out in this very way 2 months prior, on the very same sheet of muslin, in fact, his lips slightly parted, one eye showing a glint of white where the lids had not been properly closed. It was a moment before Devlin realized who the dead man really was.
The shot was mine, said Shepherd calmly. He was drawing his pistol on Carver, meaning to shoot him in the back. Through the window. I caught him just in time.
Devlin found his voice at last.
You couldn't have disarmed him.
No, said Shepherd. Not in the moment. It was his life or Carver's.
Margaret Shepherd let out a sob.
But I don't understand, Devlin said, glancing at her and then back at Shepherd. What was he doing, drawing a pistol on Carver?
Perhaps you might clear up the chaplain's confusion, Margaret, said George Shepherd, addressing his wife, who sobbed a second time. Reverend, I'll be wanting you to dig another grave.
Surely his body ought to be sent home to his people, Devlin said, frowning.
This one has no people, said Shepherd.
How do you know that? Said Devlin.
Again, said Shepherd. Perhaps you ought to ask my wife.
Mrs. Shepherd? Said Devlin uncertainly.
Margaret Shepherd gasped and covered her face with her hands. Shepherd turned to her.
Compose yourself, he said. Don't be a child.
The woman took her hands from her face at once.
Forgive me, Reverend, she whispered,
without looking at him. Her face was very white.
That's quite all right, said Devlin, frowning. You're in shock, that's all. Perhaps you ought to lie down.
George, she whispered.
I consider that you did the ethical thing today, the jailer said, staring at her. I commend you for it.
At this, Mrs. Shepherd's face crumpled. She clapped her hands over her mouth and ran from the room.
My apologies, said the jailer to Devlin when she was gone. My wife has a volatile temperament, as you can see.
I do not fault her, Devlin said. The relations between Shepherd and his wife troubled him extremely, but he knew better than to give voice to his fears. It is very natural to feel overcome in the presence of the dead, all the more so if one has a personal history with the deceased.
Shepherd was staring down at Sukyong Sheng's body.
Devlin, he said after a moment, looking up, will you share a drink with me?
Devlin was surprised. The jailer had never made such an invitation before.
I would be honoured, he said, still speaking carefully. But perhaps we might go into the parlour, or out onto the porch, where we will not disturb Mrs. Shepherd's rest.
Yes.
Shepherd went to his liquor cabinet.
Do you have a taste for brandy or for whisky? I have both.
Well, Devlin said, surprised again, it's been an awfully long time since I had a drop of whisky. Some whisky would be very nice.
Kirk Liston is what I have, said Shepherd,
plucking out the bottle and holding it up.
It's tolerable stuff.
He stacked two glasses, swept them up into his great hand, and gestured for Devlin to open the door. The police camp courtyard was deserted and chilly in the dark. All the buildings opposite were shuttered, their inhabitants abed. The wind had dropped at sundown, and it was almost perfectly quiet, the silence like the surface of a pond. The only sound came from the moths bumping against the glass globe that hung in a bracket beside the cottage door. There came a fizz of light each time a moth spiraled down into the flame, and then a dusty, acrid smell as its body burned. Shepherd set out the glasses on the banister rail and poured them both a measure.
Margaret was my brother's wife, he said,
handing one of the glasses to Devlin and draining the other.
My older brother, Jeremy. I married her after Jeremy died.
Thank you,
Devlin murmured, accepting the glass and holding the liquor to his nose. The jailer had been too modest. The whisky was more than tolerable. In Hokitika, a bottle of Kirk Liston cost 18 shillings, and double that whenever spirits were scarce.
The White Horse Saloon, the jailer was saying. That was the name of the place. A dockside tavern at Darling Harbour. He was shot through the temple.
Devlin sipped at his whisky. The taste was smoky and slightly musty. It put him in mind of cured meats and new books and barnyards and cloves.
So I married his wife,
Shepherd went on, pouring himself another measure.
It was the moral thing to do. I am not like my brother, Reverend. neither in temperament nor in taste. He was a dissolute. I do not mean to commend myself by contrast, but the difference between us was very often remarked. It had been remarked since our childhoods. I knew virtually nothing of his marriage to Margaret. She was a barmaid. She was not a beauty, as you know. But I married her. I did the dutiful thing. I married her and provided for her in her loss, and together we waited for the trial.
Devlin nodded mutely, staring at his whiskey, turning the small glass around in his hand. He was thinking of Sukyong Sheng lying cold on the floor inside, his chin and throat smeared with bootblack, his eyebrows thickened like a clown.
"Poor, brutish Jeremy," Shepherd said. "I never admired him, and to my knowledge he never admired me. He was a terrible brawler. I expected that one of his brawls would turn fatal sooner or later. They happened often enough. When I first learned that he had been murdered, I wasn't terribly surprised."
He drained his glass again and refilled it. Devlin waited for him to go on.
"It was a Johnny Chinaman who did it. Jeremy had kicked him about in the street. Shamed him, most likely. The chink came back to seek redress. Found my brother sleeping off a bottle in a rented room above the tavern. Picked up Margaret's pistol from beside his bed, put the muzzle to his temple. And that was that. Then he tried to run, of course, but he was stupid about it. He didn't get further than the edge of the quay. He was tripped up by a sergeant and thrown in jail that very night. The trial was scheduled for 6 weeks later."
Again, Shepherd drained his glass. Devlin was surprised. He had never seen the jailer drink before, except at mealtimes or as medicine. Perhaps the death of Ah Suk had unsettled him.
"The trial ought to have been straightforward," the jailer went on, pouring himself a fourth measure. His face had become rather flushed. "First, of course, the suspect was a chink. Second, he had ample provocation to wish my brother harm. Third, he had not a word of English to defend himself. There was no doubt in anybody's minds that the chink was guilty. They'd all heard the shot go off. They'd all seen him running. But then comes Margaret Shepherd into the witness box. My new wife, don't forget. We've been married less than a month. She sits down, and this is what she says. 'My husband wasn't murdered by that Chinaman,' she says. 'My husband was killed by his own hand, and I know it, because I witnessed his suicide myself.'"
Devlin wondered whether Margaret Shepherd was listening from inside.
"There wasn't a word of truth to it," the jailer said. "Complete fabrication. She lied. Under oath. She defiled her late husband's memory, my brother's memory, by calling him a suicide. And all to protect that worthless chink from the punishment that he deserved. He would have swung without a doubt. He should have swung. It was his crime, and it went unpunished."
"How can you be sure that your wife wasn't telling the truth?" said Devlin.
"How can I be sure?"
Shepherd reached for the bottle again.
"My brother was not a suicidal type," he said. "That's how. You'll have another?"
"Please," Devlin said, holding out his glass. It was rare that he tasted whiskey.
"I can see that you're doubtful, Reverend," said Shepherd, as he poured. "But there's just no other way to say it. Jeremy was not a suicidal type. No more than I am."
"But what reason could Mrs. Shepherd have had to lie under oath?"
"She was fond of him," said Shepherd shortly.
"This Chinaman?" said Devlin.
"Yes," said Shepherd. "The late Mr. Suk. They had a history together. You can be sure I didn't see that coming. By the time I found out, however, she was already my wife.
Devlin sipped again at his whiskey. They were silent for a long while, looking out at the shadowed forms of the buildings opposite. Presently, Devlin said,
"You haven't mentioned Francis Carver."
"Oh, Carver," said Shepherd, swirling his glass. "Yes."
"What is his association with Mr. Sook?" said Devlin, to prompt him.
"They had a history," said Shepherd. "Some bad blood. A trading dispute."
This much Devlin knew already. "Yes?"
"I've been keeping a watch on Sook since Darling Harbour. I got word this morning that he had bought a pistol from the outfitters on Camp Street, and I applied for a warrant for his arrest at once."
"You would arrest a man simply for purchasing a pistol?"
"Yes, if I knew what he meant to do with it. Sook had sworn to take Carver's life. He'd sworn to it. I knew that when he finally caught up with Carver, it would be murder or nothing. As soon as I heard about the pistol, I called the alarm. Staked out the Palace Hotel. Sent word ahead to Carver, letting him know. Gave the message to the bellman to cry along the road. I was one step behind him until the very last."
"And in the last?" said Devlin after a moment.
Shepherd fixed him with a cold look.
"I told you what happened."
"It was his life or Carver's," Devlin said.
"I acted inside the law," Shepherd said.
"I'm sure you did," Devlin said.
"I had a warrant for his arrest."
"I do not doubt it."
"Revenge," said Shepherd firmly, "is an act of jealousy, not of justice. It is a selfish perversion of the law."
"Revenge is certainly selfish," Devlin agreed, "but I doubt it has very much to do with the law."
He finished his whiskey, and Shepherd, after a long moment, did the same.
"I'm very sorry about your brother, Mr. Shepherd," Devlin said, placing his glass on the banister.
"Yes, well," said Shepherd, as he corked the whiskey bottle, "that was years ago. What's done is done."
"Some things are never done," said the chaplain. "We do not forget those whom we have loved. We cannot forget them."
Shepherd glanced at him. "You speak as though from experience."
Devlin did not answer at once. After a pause, he said,
"If I have learned one thing from experience, it is this. Never underestimate how extraordinarily difficult it is to understand a situation from another person's point of view."
The jailer only grunted at this. He watched as Devlin descended the steps into the shadows of the courtyard. At the horse post, the chaplain turned and said,
"I'll be at Sea View first thing in the morning, to begin digging the grave."
Shepherd had not moved.
"Good night, Cowell."
"Good night, Mr. Shepherd."
The jailer watched until Devlin had rounded the side of the jailhouse, and then he pinched the empty glasses between his finger and his thumb, picked up the bottle, and went inside. The jailhouse door stood part way open, and the duty sergeant was sitting just inside the entrance, his rifle laid across his knees. He asked with his eyebrows whether the chaplain meant to step inside.
"They're all abed, I'm afraid," he said, his voice low.
"That's all right," said Devlin, also speaking quietly. "I'll only be a moment."
The bullet had been removed from Stain's shoulder, and his wound had been stitched. His filthy clothes had been cut from his body, and the dirt washed from his face and hair. He had been dressed in moleskin trousers and a loose twill shirt, donated by Tigreen's Hardware, on promise of payment the following day. Throughout all these ministrations, the boy had drifted in and out of consciousness, mumbling Anna's name. When he became aware, however, that the physician meant to install him at the Criterion Hotel opposite the police camp, his eyes snapped open at once. He would not leave Anna. He would not go anywhere that Anna did not go. He put up such a fuss to this effect that at length the physician agreed to placate him. A bed was made up for him at the jailhouse next to where Anna lay, and it was decided that Staines would be manacled like the others in the interests of preventing disharmony. The boy consented to the manacle without protest, lay down, and reached out a hand to touch Anna's cheek. After a time, his eyes closed, and he slept. Since then, he had not woken. He and Anna lay facing each other, Staines lying on his left hip and Anna on her right, both of them with their knees drawn up to their chests. Staines with one hand tucked beneath his bandaged shoulder, Anna with one arm tucked beneath her cheek. She must have turned towards him some time in the night. Her left arm was flung outward, her fingers reaching, her palm turned down. Devlin came closer. He felt overcome, though by what kind of sentiment he did not exactly know. George Shepherd's whiskey had warmed his chest and stomach. There was a blurry tightness in his skull, a blurry heat behind his eyes. But the jailer's story had made him feel wretched, even chilled. Perhaps he was about to weep. It would feel good to weep. What a day it had been. His heart was heavy, his limbs exhausted. He looked down at Anna and Emery, their mirrored bodies facing in. They were breathing in tandem. So they are lovers, he thought, looking down at them. So they are lovers, after all. He knew it from the way that they were sleeping. Part 4. Paingafafa, the 27th of April, 1865, 45 degrees 52 minutes south, 170 degrees 30 minutes east, Dunedin. And the 27th of April, 1866, 42 degrees 43 minutes south, 170 degrees 58 minutes east, Hokitika. First point of Aries, in which a steamer arrives in Port Chalmers from Sydney and two passengers aroused before the rest. Anna Wetherill's first glimpse of New Zealand was of the rocky heads of the Otago Peninsula, mottled cliffs that dropped sharply into the white foam of the water, and above them a rumpled cloak of grasses raked by the wind. It was just past dawn. A pale fog was rising from the ocean, obscuring the far end of the harbour, where the hills became blue and then purple as the inlet narrowed and closed to a point. The sun was still low in the east, throwing a slick of yellow light over the water and lending an orange tint to the rocks on the western shore. The city of Dunedin was not yet visible, tucked as it was behind the elbow of the harbour, and there were no dwellings or livestock on this stretch of coastline. Anna's first impression was of a lonely throat of water, a clear sky, and a rugged land untouched by human life or industry. The first sighting had occurred in the grey hours that preceded the dawn, and so Anna had not witnessed the smudge on the horizon growing and thickening to form the contour of the peninsula as the steamer came nearer and nearer to the coast. She had been woken some hours later by a strange cacophony of unfamiliar bird calls, from which she deduced rightly that they must be nearing land at last. She eased herself from her berth, taking care not to wake the other women, and fixed her hair and stockings in the dark. By the time she came up the iron ladder to the deck, wrapping her shawl about her shoulders, the fortunate wind was rounding the outer heads of the harbour, and the peninsula was all around her. The relief, sudden and impossible, after long weeks at sea. "Magnificent, aren't they?" Anna turned. A fair-haired boy in a felt cap was leaning against the portside rail. He gestured to the cliffs, and Anna saw the birds whose rancorous call had roused her from her slumber. They hung in a cloud about the cliff face, wheeling, turning, and catching the light. She came forward to the rail. They looked to her like very large gulls, their wings black on the tops and white beneath, their heads perfectly white, their beaks stout and pale. As she watched, one made a low pass in front of the boat, its wingtip skimming the surface of the water. "Beautiful," she said. "Are they petrels,
Or gannets, maybe. They're albatrosses.
The boy was beaming.
They're real albatrosses. Just wait till this fellow comes back. He will in a moment. He's been circling the ship for some time. Good Lord, what a feeling that must be to fly. Can you imagine it?
Anna smiled. She watched as the albatross glided away from them, turned, and began climbing on the wind.
They're terrifically good luck, albatrosses, the boy was saying, and they're the most incredible flies. One hears stories of them following ships for months and months, and through all manner of weather, halfway around the world sometimes. Lord only knows where these ones have been, and what they've witnessed, for that matter.
When it turned on its side, it became almost invisible, a needle of white, pale against the sky.
So few birds are truly mythical,
the boy went on, still watching the albatross.
I mean, there are ravens, I suppose, and perhaps you might say that doves have a special meaning too, but no more than owls do, or eagles. An albatross is different. It has such a weight to it, such symbolism. It's angelic, almost. Even saying the name, one feels a kind of thrill. I'm so glad to have seen one. I feel almost touched. And how wonderful that they guard the mouth of the harbour like they do. How's that for an omen? For a gold town? I heard them calling. That was what roused me. And I came topside because I couldn't place the sound. I thought it was pigs at first.
Anna looked at him sidelong. Was the boy making an overture of friendship? He was speaking as if they were close familiars, though in fact they had not exchanged more than perfunctory greetings on the journey from Sydney, Anna having kept largely to the women's quarters and the boy to the men's. She did not know his name. She had seen him from a distance, of course, but he had not made any particular impression upon her, good or bad. She saw now that he was something of an eccentric.
Their calling roused me too, she said. And then, I suppose I ought to go and wake the others. It's too perfect a sight to be missed. Don't, the boy said. Oh, don't, would you mind? I couldn't bear to have a crowd of people jostling about, not at this hour. Somebody's bound to say, instead of the cross, the albatross, or he stoppeth one of three, and then the rest of the journey would be quite lost to argument. Everyone trying to piece together the poem, I mean, and quarrelling over which pieces go where, with each man trumping the next and showing off his memory. Let's just enjoy it for ourselves. Dawn is such a private hour, don't you think? Such a solitary hour. One always hears that said of midnight. But I think of midnight as remarkably companionable. Everyone together, sleeping in the dark. I'm afraid I'm interrupting your solitude. Anna said. No, no, the boy said. Oh, no! Solitude is a condition best enjoyed in company.
He grinned at her, quickly, and Anna smiled back.
Especially the company of one other soul, he added, turning back to the sea. It's dreadful to feel alone and really be alone. But I love to enjoy the feeling when I'm not. Hark at him, the beauty. He'll circle back in a moment. Birds always make me think of ships, Anna said.
He turned to her, eyes wide.
Do they? He said.
Anna blushed under his direct attention. The boy's eyes were a deep brown. His brows were thick and his lips very full. He was wearing a felt cap with a flat brim. Beneath it, his hair was a dark gold, rather unruly where it curled around his temples and over his ears. Clearly it had been cropped close some months ago, and he had not returned to the barber since.
"It's just a fancy," she said, becoming shy.
"But you must follow through," said the boy. "You must. Go on."
"Heavy ships are so graceful in the water,"
Anna said at last, looking away.
"Compared to lighter crafts, I mean. If a boat is too light, if it bobs about on the waves, there's no grace to its motion. I believe that it's the same with birds. Large birds are not buffeted about by the wind. They always look so regal on the air. This fellow, seeing him fly is like seeing a heavy ship cut through a wave."
They watched as the albatross circled back to make his pass again. Anna stole a look at the boy's shoes.
They were brown leather, tightly laced, neither too shiny nor too worn, giving her no clues about his origin. In all likelihood, he was coming to make his fortune on the Otago goldfields, like every other man on board.
"You're quite right," the boy cried. "Yes, indeed. It's not at all like watching a sparrow, is it? He's weighted. Exactly like a ship, exactly so."
"I should like to see him in a storm," said Anna.
"What a peculiar wish," said the boy, delighted. "But yes, now that you say it, I believe I feel the same way. I should like to see him in a storm as well."
They lapsed into silence. Anna waited for the boy to offer his name, but he did not speak again, and presently their solitude was interrupted by the arrival of others on deck. The boy doffed his hat, and Anna dropped a curtsy. In the next moment he was gone. Anna turned back to the ocean. The colony was behind them now, and the grunts and squeals of the albatrosses had dwindled to nothing, swallowed by the deep thrum of the steamer and the great roaring hush of the sea. Mercury in Pisces, Saturn conjunct Moon. In which Cowell Devlin makes a request, Walter Moody shows his mettle, and George Shepherd is unpleasantly surprised. Since the night of the autumnal equinox, both Anna Wetherill and Emery Staines had remained incarcerated in the police camp jail. Anna's bail had been set at £8, an outrageous sum, and one she could not possibly hope to pay without external help. This time, of course, she had no fortune sewn into her clothing to use as surety, and no employer who might consent to pay the debt on her behalf. Emery Staines might have stood her the money had he not been remanded in custody on a charge of his own. He had been arrested on the morning following his reappearance on charges of fraud, embezzlement, and dereliction. His bail had been set at £1.1, the standard rate, but he had opted not to pay it, preferring instead to remain with Anna and to await his summons to the magistrate's court. Following their reunion, Anna's health began to improve almost at once. Her wrists and forearms thickened, her face lost its pinched, starved quality, and the colour returned to her cheeks. This improvement was noted with satisfaction by the physician, Dr. Gillies, who in the weeks after the equinox had visited the police camp jailhouse nearly every day. He had spoken to Anna very sternly about the dangers of opium, expressing his fervent hope that her most recent collapse had cautioned her never to touch a pipe again. She had been lucky twice now, but she could not expect to be lucky a third time. "Luck," he said, "has a way of running short, my dear." He prescribed to her a decreasing dosage of laudanum as a means of weaning her by degrees from her addiction. To Emery Staines, Dr. Gillies prescribed the very same. 5 drams of laudanum daily, reducible by 1 dram a fortnight, until his shoulder had completely healed. The wound was looking much better for having been sewn and dressed, and although the joint was very stiff, and he could not yet raise his arm above his head, his health was likewise very rapidly improving. When Cowell Devlin brought the jar of laudanum into the police camp jailhouse each night, he watched eagerly as the chaplain poured the rust-coloured liquid into 2 tin cups. Staines could not account for his sudden and inconsolable thirst for the drug. Anna, however, did not seem to relish the daily dosage at all, and even wrinkled her nose at the smell. Devlin mixed the laudanum with sugar, and sometimes with sweet cherry, to allay the tincture's bitter taste, and then, under the physician's strict instruction, he stood over the 2 felons as they drank their 2 measures down. It rarely took long for the opiate to take effect. Within minutes they sighed, became drowsy, and passed into the underwater moonscape of a strange scarlet-tinted sleep. They slept, over the coming weeks, through a great many changes in Hokitika. On the 1st day of April, Alistair Lauderback was elected as the inaugural MP for the newly formed electoral district of Westland, achieving the majority by a triumphant margin of 300 votes. In his speech of acceptance, he praised Hokitika, calling the town New Zealand's Nugget.
He went on to express his great sorrow at the prospect of quitting the place so soon, and assured the voting public that he would take the best interests of the common digger with him to the new capital city the following month, where he would serve his term in Parliament as a faithful Westland man. After Lauderback's speech, the magistrate shook his hand very warmly, and the commissioner led three rounds of huzzah. On the 12th of April, the walls of George Shepherd's jailhouse and asylum went up at last. The felons, Anna and Emery included, had been transferred from the temporary quarters at the police camp to the new building upon the terrace of Sea View, where Mrs. George was already installed as matron. Since Ah Suk's death, she had been kept very busy, hemming blankets, sewing uniforms, cooking, tabulating stores, and making up weekly rations of tobacco and salt. She was seen, if possible, even less frequently than before. She spent her evenings in the Sea View graveyard, and her nights in the residence alone. On the 16th, Francis Carver and Lydia Wells were finally married, before a crowd that, as the society pages of the West Coast Times had it, befit, in dress, number and demeanour, the marriage of a widowed bride. The day after the wedding, the groom received a large cash payment from the Garrity Group, with which his creditors were paid in full. The last of the copper plating was pried from Godspeed's hull, and the bones of the ship were given up at long last for salvage. He had ended his board at the Palace Hotel, and was now installed at the Wayfarer's Fortune with his wife. Over this time, a great many men had tramped up the switchback trail to the terrace at Sea View in order to beg an interview with Emery Staines. Carol Devlin, on the jailer's strict instruction, turned each man away, assuring them that, yes, Staines was alive, and that, yes, he was recuperating from a very grave illness, and that, yes, he would be released from custody in due course, pending the verdict of the magistrate's court. The only exception the chaplain made was for Teirau Taufare, to whom Staines had become, over the course of the past month, extraordinarily attached. Taufare rarely stayed long at the jailhouse, but his visits had such an advantageous effect upon Staines' mood and health that Devlin soon began to look forward to them also. Staines, Devlin discovered, was a sweet-natured, credulous lad, ready with a smile and full of naive affection for the foibles